Hello, I'm Julianne Good, and this is Psych One-on-One. Happy Veterans Day to everybody and all of our veterans. Thank you for serving our country. And my special little guest here is Melvin Ishmael Johnson.
Yeah, hey, so glad to be here. Finally get a chance to sit on the other side for a while.
Yeah, Melvin is a veteran, and he is also the host of the show that's on after mine, Qumran Report. And he's going to tell us a little bit about a special event on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got the second annual downtown Los Angeles stand down coming up this Saturday, November the 16th. 2013, 8 o'clock a.m. to 3 o'clock p.m., and it's at the Vortex, which is right on the corner of Santa Fe and Olympic Boulevard. The exact address is 2341 East Olympic Boulevard, Los Angeles, California, 90021. And we will have eligibility screening, medical exam, shelter and housing referral, substance abuse treatment, counseling, clothing, hygiene kit giveaway, continental breakfast and lunch served, entertainment, and much, much more. So come on out. One special event that we will have is for the first time at a stand down, we will have our own site broadcasting where Skid Row Studios will be out, and we'll be able to broadcast all over the world to touch base with all of these other veterans out here.
That's totally awesome. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for getting us involved in this, Melvin. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And I know you're getting ready to have a great show. I'll be listening.
All right. And everybody tune in for Melvin's show afterwards, the Qumran Report. Thank you, Melvin.
Thank you.
All right. And my special guest also, I have a lot of special guests tonight, yay, is Stevon Lewis. We are going to be talking about teen psychology this evening. And let me tell you a little bit about Stevon. He is a therapist who practices in the Long Beach and South Bay areas. He earned his Bachelor's of Arts degrees in psychology and Afroethnic studies from California State University in Fullerton. He also has a Master's of Science degree in counseling with an emphasis in marriage and family therapy from California State University in Long Beach. Since 2007, Stevon has been employed as a therapist at a community mental health agency in Long Beach, working with the families of adolescents involved with the juvenile justice system. He currently serves as the program manager for its functional family therapy program. In addition, Stevon has a group practice in Torrance where he works with families, teens, individuals, adults, and couples dealing with depression, bipolar disorder, bullying, domestic violence, anxiety, trauma, grief and loss, stress, men's issues, and parenting. He has been trained as a sexual assault crisis counselor and has taught an introduction to psychology course at Los Angeles Harbor Community College. Welcome, Stevon.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I'm happy you're here. It's good to see you again.
Yes, pleasure.
I've got a first question for you. Are teens an overlooked population in therapy?
Yes, I would think so. Teens are often, I think, by therapists, not really sought after as clients. I think that they've been kind of marginalized in a sense that they've been, you know, they're tough to deal with. We label them as, you know, sometimes troubled teens, that they don't, how do I kind of connect with them? You know, you have a 13-year-old, if I'm, say, 45, 50 years old, there's a large gap in age. So how do I really connect and understand, or how do I show them that I understand, you know, where they're coming from? So there's always kind of this hesitancy, I think, to kind of work with this population, because there's this feeling that, you know, one, I'm not going to get them, or they aren't going to accept me, or that, you know, they may feel that, oh, this person's not going to get me, so I'm not really, you know, looking to go out and try to get some assistance or help from them.
Yeah, and they may also look at you as like, okay, well, you're my parents' age or my caretaker's age, and go, okay, why should I trust you because you're older, you don't quite get it. And that's always the funny thing is like, well, we've been there, we've done it, we do understand it, and just trying to set up that connection of establishing trust.
Absolutely. And that's tough with this population because they do see you as their parent, not so much as their equal. And there's this, you know, kind of tendency to put you in that category as a therapist, you know, as an adult. and say all adults are the same. You know, you're just like my principal. You're just like my uncle, my father, my mother. And that, you know, you aren't going to get me. You're going to see that I'm the problem and you're going to blame me for everything that's going on. You know, so trying to find a way to for you to really be able to connect and kind of get yourself out of that role that you might be kind of placed in. Mm-hmm. It takes real skill as a therapist to do. And so, you know, I don't think that, you know, many therapists are able to do it or, you know, do it really, really well.
It is an art, isn't it?
it absolutely is. I mean, you know, teens will bring in a lot of different stuff and, you know, different personalities. It's hard to kind of stay abreast of, you know, what's new for them, what they're interested into. It changes weekly. And then also kind of, you know, trying to make a connection with them, saying that, hey, I do get you. And it's not common for an adult for them to feel like an adult understands them or is listening to them. So they're often, you know, not heard. So I really like, you know, when I'm working with teens is to really try to give them a voice. And so that's why I try to, you know, bring in the family and make that happen.
So what is one technique that you use to start bridging that gap and establishing that bridge of trust?
So more common or oftentimes what you'll get is that teens will, you know, be called in or they'll come into therapy as a result of something that's gone wrong. You know, they're the problem. They've gotten into trouble. You know, they've done something and now everybody says, well, we need to get this person help. And so what I do is kind of at the outset is when I'm working with a teen is I try to change the way that I'm perceiving them. So most people have already told them, you know, you need to fix your act. You need to clean up your act. You need to change what it is you've been doing. You're getting in trouble. You're failing school. This ditching you're doing, you got to stop that. It's the people you hang around. And what I like to say is I try to, you know, say something to the effect that I see that, you know, these things have been going on and I'm not sure that this is an accurate picture of who you are. But, you know, people will, you know, accept this as being true. But I want to hear from you kind of who you are and I want to get to know you on that level personally, because I don't think that, you know, the things we've been seeing or hearing about you is exactly, you know, what it is that the type of person that you actually are.
Yeah, you give them that benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of like a neutral platform that hopefully they can, you know, set up base on and say, oh, okay, well, this adult's different. He seems to be kind of cool or whatever word they want to use for it now.
Hopefully they call me cool. Probably not.
Okay. Well, what would they call you?
Someone who gives them an opportunity to kind of speak or share their story. I remember kind of first when I started doing therapy or was still in school, you know, learning how to do therapy and, you know, the technique of kind of approaching people as the concept of the iceberg, where, you know, they say most of what an iceberg, most of the mass or the size of an iceberg is really underneath the surface of the water. And so really approaching teens with that sense that, you know, you've got these things that are going on, these behaviors that maybe have gotten you in trouble or people kind of misunderstanding you, but really who you are is beneath all of that. So I've got to get under that stuff that you're bringing, you're presenting every day and say that that's not the real you. And that, you know, whatever's driving that stuff or that behavior is kind of what's really going on. And if we can get to that, then, you know, people have a better understanding and it'll change how they react to you.
Exactly. There's so much underneath the surface, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just so much. I would like to reach out to the listeners. If you would like to join us in our discussion with Stevon Lewis about teen psychology, the number is 800-893-9562. Again, that's 800-893-9562. So when you're digging down and trying to find the bottom of that iceberg, how long does that take approximately? I mean, I know that's going to be different from teen to teen, but is there kind of a ballpark range that you can start digging down and bringing the really deep issues to the surface?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question, because it does vary from teen to teen. Some teens are, you know, more verbal, more willing to talk. If they feel like, you know, someone is ready to listen. Some are more closed off. And what I found is that, you know, it's about 3 to 5 sessions is what it usually takes. You know, say sometimes it's a little bit shorter, sometimes a little bit longer. But for you to be able to kind of get underneath to what's really going on, where teens feel safe that they can open up to you and be honest about stuff. So what you'll find is that they'll oftentimes give you little snippets of kind of who they are and see if they can trust you with that information. So I'll share a little bit, but not the full story. I'll give you just a piece of it and see how you react to that. And if you do just like the other adults have been doing in my life, when I show them a little bit of what's really going on with me, then I won't share anymore. But if you're able to handle that, then maybe you're possibly able to kind of handle a little bit more.
So they test you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, definitely. What has been one of the most prevalent problems that teens have come in and wanted to share with you and resolve?
So usually it's actually something that's probably going on in the home, something that they want to share with a parent, but don't feel safe in doing so. They don't feel that the parent may receive it well. A lot of times it's protective, that they don't want to hurt their parents' feelings in an already, tough situation where maybe their relationship isn't already good. So the last thing that, I as a teen want to do is make that relationship worse. So maybe I'll just kind of, not say anything about it. So oftentimes I'll get parents that bring teens in or bring their kids in, and it's because something's happened. So this kid's maybe gotten arrested. Maybe they're, acting out of school. They're getting into fights. They're ditching. All these things that say, oh, there's a trouble there. There's something going on. But usually I think the tendency is to kind of stop there. It's to say that, well, there's something going on. Let's, stop this kid from doing these bad things. And so oftentimes parents will bring kids to me and say, hey, well, you need to fix this person. And, my tendency is, well, hey, wait a second. I need you to stay because what happens, this kid doesn't live in a bubble. And I'm sure whatever he's doing or she's doing is impacting everybody else in the household. So, if you're looking at behaviors where this kid's getting kicked out of school or fighting, that means mom or dad has to go up to the school now. Now that's taking time away from work. So it's impacting the rest of the family. If this kid is cutting or something like that, then, parents are worried about the safety. That worry starts to do something. Again, it's not that this kid's just alone, isolated in a bubble, but it's impacting the rest of the family. So I think that, it starts with these behaviors that are, show or shed a light and say, hey, look at me, something's going on. And then we have to kind of, what I do is I go deeper and try to find out what that stuff is. I mean, is there anger underneath that? Who's that anger directed at? Is there pain under there? Where's that pain coming from? What's causing it? And then really getting to have a conversation about that stuff with the parent in the room. And I think that that's kind of how you get the most bang for your buck, so to speak, when not working with teens.
And hopefully the parents are open to coming in and getting counseling also, because I've worked with families and sometimes the parents are like going, just fix my child. And I agree with you about he or she doesn't live in a bubble. Mm-hmm. They live with you most of the time. So no, I can't just magically fix your child here. You need to be involved in this process and come to, grips and reality about there are problems happening at home that need to be changed, that need to be worked on.
Absolutely. That is exactly it. Parents will come in and say, well, I'm doing my part, right? And it's hard to kind of say to a mom or dad that, well, yeah, you are, but, that's kind of tough for them to hear. Because, again, this kid's doing stuff and the parents like, well, hey, I'm providing a roof over the head. All the needs are met. I don't know why they're doing this. But, again, you have to be there for that conversation. And so that's what I kind of tell parents when they bring their kids in or when something's going on is that, you're kind of a good support. You're going to be the best support that they have mm-hmm. to be able to get through whatever's going on. And so, know that they have their family that they can count on to be supportive of them as they work through this process of whatever's happening or causing them problems in their life mm-hmm. is going to be huge. It's going to be huge. And also it might, help you guys to kind of see them differently in that, maybe they aren't just this bad kid that loves to ditch school and, steal things, that there's something really going on that they haven't been able to talk to you about. And it's going to be important to know that for them to know to be able to get better, that you're willing to listen and, kind of be supportive through that process.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. And they have to be open for that conversation,
absolutely.
Don't they? So typically, what would you see, the child first and then the family or the family? What is your typical therapy construct?
So when I work with teens, I like to see the whole family at outset, even at intake and when I'm doing an assessment. because there's lots of information that you might not get from a teen about stuff that happened when they were way younger that, you know, they might not remember, but could have been impactful, like, you know, a major move, a family member coming into the home that, you know, wasn't always there, or maybe dad leaving, or things like that, that, you know, teen might not remember that happened when they were, you know, really young, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old. And some of that, you know, developmental history stuff that you need to get is going to come from the parent. You know, how was the birth? You know, how were they as a child? Were they colicky? How did that impact you guys' relationship? All that stuff is real pertinent information. But also I need to get, you know, information from the teen as well, because what I'll get from the parent is all the bad stuff that this kid's doing, right? And, you know, there's a tendency to kind of focus on that stuff and miss that, you know, sometimes this kid's doing some right stuff. They're doing something right, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's nothing, you know, no one ever talks about that, though. Or the time when the kid, you know, went 3 weeks without ditching school. What was going on there? We missed that piece. And so it's important for that kid to have a voice and be able to say, hey, well, yeah, when I did that, you know, nobody recognized it. So it was like, why try? These are important conversations to have. I've also kind of found that when we're talking about kids and teens getting into trouble, that when you go a little bit under that surface and you start to talk to them about what's really going on and it relates to a parent, it's important for that parent to be able to hear that and for the kid to kind of have that conversation. That's why I like to do family work, because, you know, it's, I can kind of propose to a teen that maybe this is what mom was thinking, or maybe this was dad was feeling as well. And, you know, maybe that might fly, but to have dad really say, well, I didn't look at it that way, or I didn't feel that way. Or to have mom say, no, I always cared about you. I never hated you for this reason. Then, you know, that's important to come from the actual person.
Some really powerful moments, I'm sure, that are happening in session, mm-hmm. which are, that's great for hope, as you know, and just to get everybody to see, wow, we really do have some connection here. But there's been so much history of the child acting out and the parents getting frustrated and labeling the child. And then this, you know, the school and maybe the legal system have also labeled the child. That makes it really, really difficult for that child to break out of that labeling, because he or she's like going, okay, well, they say I'm like this, they say I'm like that, so maybe I am. So I'm going to just keep on acting out that part. And it almost takes on a life of its own, wouldn't you say?
Exactly. That's exactly it. I remember working with a family where, you know, kid 17, he's been getting in trouble at school, on the verge of ending up on probation. You know, this kid comes from a good home. It's not, you know, this kid comes from a home where he's struggling, the parents are struggling. His parents are, you know, well off. You know, I think mother was maybe like a physician assistant or something like that. So, you know, lots of education. And, you know, he's ditching school, you know, using drugs, getting into fights. And, you know, his mom's frustrated, dad's frustrated, everybody's kind of upset. And, you know, I think the tendency was to kind of say, well, this kid likes to smoke weed or do what it is, do things like that. And, you know, he gets into trouble at school, and it's because he's bad. He just doesn't want to listen. And he likes things his own way. And so what he came to find out was that, you know, as I talked to the family a little bit more, is that this kid, when he was young, you know, was a survivor of cancer. You know, that was a tough process for the family in general. His mom during that time was real nurturing, real supportive, real reinforcing. And you know, dad, his relationship with his dad was always sort of rocky, even though dad lived in the home. And I think it was kind of just something culturally for this family. And so, you know, in talking with the kid, is that he had kind of grown accustomed to getting a lot of that reinforcement, that support, that nurturing from mom. And when he was older, that stuff started to stop. So mom wasn't as, you know, forgiving, nurturing, reinforcing when he was getting in trouble as a teen. And so he kind of internalized that as, you know, maybe mom doesn't care, or, you know, she doesn't love me, or, you know, for him, I think we talked about him not being able to maybe meet these expectations because his parents were kind of so well off and had attained a lot of education, and that maybe that he wasn't going to be that way. And so if he didn't accomplish those things, was his family still going to love him? Was his mom still going to care about him? And I remember, like, during the session, it was during one of the sessions, it was a point when I had asked mom, kind of, I think, you know, and I'm talking to mom and I'm saying, well, I think for, you know, this kid, let's call him Bobby, that, you know, for Bobby, he wants to kind of know whether or not if he's a one, you know, the worst person you could think of, or a 10, the best kid you could ever have, if you're still going to love him, because he might end up being a 4 or a 7. And so mom was, you know, kind of glossed over that fact and, you know, started to kind of move on to another subject. And he kind of interrupted the session and said, answer the question. And so it was a real powerful moment for me. So I kind of, you know, stepped back and sat back in my seat, because this was the question that he wanted to ask mom. And so it was an opportunity for them to have that dialogue. And they were able to kind of process that. And mom said, I'm here for you. I'm always going to be here for you. And he was saying, well, sometimes it doesn't feel that way. And it was important for them to have that exchange, which I don't think would have been able to happen if it was just him in the room.
Wow. That's a great story. Yeah, because you do. And you have a good point there, too. There are kids that get into trouble that are from, you know, better off economic situations and neighborhoods, and, you know, then the parents are scratching their heads like, where did we go wrong? And I think that's still one of the common questions. Where did we go wrong? Because it is always a reflection on the parenting, no matter what, no matter whether the child made his or her own choice, you know, it's going to come back to, you know, pointing the fingers at the parents. So that was a great story.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Yeah. Very interesting. We are going to cut for a commercial. We were going to come back with Stevon Lewis on Skid Row Studios.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at 3 campuses: Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
And thank you to the Chicago School for sponsoring Psych 1-on-1. Stevon, let's talk about the other side of the coin.
Okay.
Let's talk about kids that you counsel that are in the juvenile justice system.
Okay. So these kids, you know, have a longer history of involvement and maybe delinquency. So the approach to working with this population is a little bit different, not so much in terms of what we're trying to do. How I talked earlier about the iceberg, we're still trying to get beneath the surface and find out what's going on with them. But there's a host of other risk factors that you got to kind of address ahead of time before you're able to get to that place. You know, I've been doing this for about 6.5 years now, working with this population, kids that are involved in the juvenile justice system. You know, that means going to probation camps, being removed from their home for, you know, 6, 12, 18 months at a time, placed out of home in a group home situation, or sent to juvenile detention centers. And when they're coming back, there's things that you got to address with the family. So oftentimes these kids are kind of mandated to do therapy, family therapy, when they're released. And part of that is you have to kind of talk about things, about going back to when this kid got in trouble. What was going on then? How did that happen? And I think families are kind of nervous, right? Because maybe this kid's been, you know, removed a couple times, you know, gang involved. And, you know, these are things that they know are going on and they can't change, because you can't, you know, don't always have the resources to say, well, I'm just going to move now. I can't move out of my area. Or, you know, what am I going to do if, you know, he's stealing because he doesn't have a lot of money. I don't have extra money to give him. So what am I going to do? And there are these fears about being able to change or being able to meet the needs of these kids as they come home. And so a lot of the conversation is about how do we make better choices in terms of, you know, responding to these needs that need to be met. So we start to look at, you know, why is it that this kid is stealing, and who else might be able to kind of help this kid meet this need in a positive way, as opposed to him having to figure it out on his own? Or if this kid's involved in gangs, what need at home, a sense of family, support, or was missing for him to feel that he needs to go to this gang? Or is it something that where the gang provides protection and he doesn't feel like his family can? You know, so you start to address these things and look at these behaviors. Again, not so much for, oh, this is a gang kid who, you know, is a menace to society and, you know, just wants to break all the rules and, you know, do all these negative things, but kind of what was the driving force behind that? How did this kid end up choosing this as an option to deal with whatever was going on?
Yeah, an expression of pain.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And the violence situation also inside and outside of the home mm-hmm. really needs to be addressed. And I would imagine with a lot of these teens that are in the system like that, mm-hmm. they're not getting much counseling, if any, when they're in these detention centers, correct?
Well, they do get some counseling, but it's usually individual. Mm-hmm. Again, so I think that's kind of where we miss a little bit, and we aren't able to kind of accomplish as much. So in a detention center, you got to think that this is an environment that's starkly different from where they've been living. Mm-hmm. Detention center has a lot of structure, a lot of rules, a lot of kind of consequences. If those rules aren't obeyed or adhered to, most of the kids in there are following the rules because they want to get out and get back home. So a lot of freedoms are taken. And then when they're doing therapy, a lot of that stuff is individual about how are you going to do this? How are you going to do that? And they will bring the parents in maybe towards the end of this, end of the child's stay, but it's only for like maybe one or two sessions, right? Not nearly long enough, I think, to kind of process some of the stuff that's really going on at home. And then the other thing is that once they're released, they go back to this home that's still the same. See, so maybe they've acquired some good skills while they were in the detention center. They learned how to kind of work through their anger stuff, how to respond to that and not really, get into fights anymore or any, some of those things that maybe were causing them problems. Mm-hmm. But then they go back home and nobody's changed there. They're in the same neighborhood. You know, sometimes maybe the gang is their family, right? So, I mean, how do I move out from my brother or my uncle? Or, maybe my mom is also involved in the gang, so now I'm going back home to this, right? And so, all the good work and stuff that they were able to do, because that's always the disconnect. I remember one time I was working with a kid, and he was coming out of camp, and that's kind of for the older kids, the 17, 18 years old, that have been, involved in the juvenile justice system or have more severe offenses. And he was coming back home, and, this was maybe his third time being removed from the home. And I remember someone asking him, well, what happened? Like, you didn't want to go back. Why'd you go back? And he started to talk about, this time I have more support. I have all these other things in play that are going to assist me. Whereas before, he would get out and he would go back home and then he would get caught up in the same stuff that he was doing. And, we all know that kind of with behavior, what's familiar is kind of what we go to. At least we know how to do that, right? It might not work. It might work, but that's what we know. And so it's not, as scary. But when he had some more support, he was able to do a little bit better.
And I would imagine, too, that a child coming back changed like that because of living in the detention centers and bringing in, new ways of doing things mm-hmm. and boundaries and rules and everything else that he was not getting at home, not getting in this neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Trying to incorporate that within a non-change system, I agree, it'd be almost impossible to withhold that because he or she's not having that support, I would imagine, to keep those new good behaviors into place.
Absolutely. That's exactly it, is that I've learned how to manage my anger, right? So I can use words better as opposed to using my fists. And, I've learned that in detention center. But then I go back home and, there's been no conversation with my mother or my siblings about what my triggers are, what things I really don't like. And then they start to continue to do that stuff. The name calling, negativity, conversations about, you better not go hang out with this person. You better not go do this, or I'll tell your probation officer. Again, those aren't kind of, positive, supporting, reinforcing things that are nurturing. And, you hear enough of that and the kid will say, well, you don't think I've changed. Maybe it's not possible for the change. And so, I'll revert back to kind of what I've been doing because kind of that's what all people see. And it's tough for kids to kind of go back into an environment like that because, again, they're not usually the ones that have, most of the power in the family. So how can I come in and say, Mom, you need to do some stuff differently? And she's going to listen to her 14, 15-year-old who's telling her, you need to parent me differently.
Right, yeah. I can't imagine being in on that conversation. Yeah, I can just see the look on the mother's or father's face and like, what, really? You're telling me, huh? Yeah, as we all do with teens anyways when they sit there and tell us about our parenting skills. Yeah. I know I've been there, done that. Luckily, my son's not a teen anymore.
Nice. But teens are a lot more, they're a lot smarter than we give them credit for.
Right.
They're a lot more aware than we give them, you know, credit for being able to kind of have that skill. And they are the ones who probably notice and are willing to be more honest about what's going on than adults are. Doing this work, I've kind of found that adults are a lot more guarded, don't really like to talk about the, you know, pitfalls of what's been going on with their family, because there's that fear of being judged, right? That, you know, oh, I'm screwing up as a parent, I've screwed this family up, or, you know, my kid's getting into this trouble because of me, that things are wrong with our family, and people are going to say, look at how messed up this family is. When, you know, in reality, this is what's going on, and nobody likes it. And you guys don't like it, right? This family doesn't like it. And so, you know, I try to have conversations with the family about that you guys have been doing something and, you know, maybe it worked for a little bit, but now it's not working anymore. And we've got to come up with some new ways because we got to do some things that are different that we haven't done before so that we can get some different results. So I think that's the way I try to, you know, get parents to kind of say, well, become less guarded, say, you know, more open to listening to, hey, you know what, maybe I do need to find a way to work with my kid a little bit better because this isn't changing. And so I never tell them that they have to change or anything like that, but let's have a conversation about what's been going on. And if it hasn't been working, let's start, you know, having a conversation about what things might work. And it's just giving that opportunity for that discussion and that sharing, I think is really important. And again, I think that's something that you can accomplish in an individual, you know, therapy session with just a teen.
And it's just setting healthy family boundaries too. Mm-hmm. Change is possible. It's a little rough at first, and you know it's a little tough hearing that things are not as good as you think that they are in your head. You're right, the guardedness mm-hmm. and the mm-hmm. oh, we've got to change and we've got some problems and we need to be real about this because our child is acting out. And we need to do something different. So it's great that you find ways to kind of soften them up and come mm-hmm. from a non-judgmental perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really what it is that they're so guarded because they don't want, nobody likes to be judged.
Right.
No one likes to feel as though they're a screw up or they're messing up or, you know, I'm the cause of, I'm a failure. Almost is kind of what it says, is that things aren't right because you failed. And, you know, no one likes to feel like that. So it's very important for me to kind of get the work that needs to happen with these families to kind of show them that, hey, I'm not judging you. You did the best, you know, the best you knew how to do with what you had, right?
Exactly. And
building that strength in them that, you know, you guys, whatever resources and stuff you learned from your parents that you knew and you learned from just kind of going on the job is that, you know, that's the stuff you use. There's no manual of, you know, how to be a perfect parent. If there were, then, you know, I'd be out of a job.
Me too.
Yeah, right. But there isn't. And so, you know, you're learning kids. I mean, you know, a parent can have three kids that are all different and you can't respond to them all the same way. And, you know, no one teaches you how to do that. But I think through the family therapy process is that, you know, I can kind of bring light onto, well, what works for this kid? And this is what will work for this kid. And have that kind of exchange of information and dialogue happen and occur that might not ever happen, you know, given, you know, that opportunity if I'm not around to, you know, be able to assist with them with that.
Right. And kind of rephrasing it too as to not, I'm a failure, but hey, I make mistakes. I'm a human being. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the multi-generational, you know, behavioral situations. It happens to all of us.
Yep.
I mean, there's things that our parents do. And then when we become parents, we go into that auto zone of, you know, this is the way I'm going to discipline my kid, even though we know underneath, it didn't work for me. Yep. And it's probably not going to work for my kid either, because he or she's going to be resistant to this, because I certainly was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just to have that thought of, you know, I need to stop, I need to do something else as a parent. I need to find better ways of disciplining my child. And they do need discipline.
Yep.
They need boundaries. And I think a lot of parents nowadays are almost going to the opposite extent and not disciplining their kids and letting them run all over the place out in public and annoying everybody around them because we can't discipline Junior here. You know, that would be just horrible. And I think that's just about as bad as going to the other extreme of spanking and hitting and yelling and punching and everything else. So, you know, they need to have guidance, period.
Absolutely. They need to have, I mean, kids crave structure.
Yes.
They live in an environment where everything they've done for most of their lives has been structured. I mean, when you talk about athletics, the rules to playing the sport, school is very structured activity. You know, they can lay out their whole day. I go from this class to this class to this class. I eat at this time. But then, you know, come home and then it's like, well, all right, kid, you make all the decisions for what needs to happen in your life now. And, you know, and they expect them to make great decisions all the time. I think that's almost kind of setting them up for failure in a sense. And, you know, parents need to be okay about, you know, setting boundaries, or if they don't, you know, want to be the one to maybe having a conversation with older kids about, you know, kind of what are going to be some agreed upon rules, some of that negotiation about what's going to be expected. When you set those expectations and keep those boundaries there, it's important. Again, that's the structure. It reinforces that because there is always going to be some level of accountability, responsibility that these kids are going to have. And if they're learning in the home, then, you know, when they go out into the rest of the world and society, then they'll be able to kind of, you know, have that, those skills and be able to match to that.
And it gives them a sense of security also.
Absolutely.
And feeling, you know, feeling precious and adored and valued because somebody is setting the rules. They're not old enough to be, you know, taking on the responsibilities of trying to, you know, gear their own lives and having too much freedom.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to really have a 15-year-old trying to figure out how to live their life when they haven't kind of experienced all the stuff that an adult has. So they're looking for direction. And if they aren't getting it from their parents, then where are they going to find it? And that's when you have, you know, kids go to gangs, or they get involved, you know, in the streets. You know, they look to other peers who, you know, frankly, probably don't have, or maybe have even have less capability or ability to do that. And so that's who they kind of seek out and go to if they aren't getting it home. And that's kind of the fear is that, you know, if parents aren't taking over that, then who will? Because it's going to have to happen. They got to have to find it from somewhere.
Yeah, and they will. They'll find it on their own if they're not getting it from home.
Yeah.
Again, if you would like to call in, the number is 800-893-9562. It's 800-893-9562. And if for any reason you need to come back to this program, these are always archived the next day at Psych One-on-One at Skid Row Studios. We are also on iTunes Store at Psych One-on-One. That's PSYCH, the number 1-O-N, and another number 1. We're also on Stitcher and Facebook. So join us and let us know what you think. So, Stevan, on the limit situation, when you're working with parents, what is one good tip that you give them almost consistently?
In being able to set limits and boundaries is to not be afraid. I think parents don't want to, they feel like they're going to alienate themselves from their kids, that they're going to push their kids away if they set up these strict boundaries and rules, and that their kids are going to hate them as a result of it, right? But rules have always been in place. I mean, you and I had to follow rules, and I'm thinking probably for the most part that, you know, these rules were set up to help us rather than, you know, make our lives terrible or the worst that they could be. So, you know, allowing parents to understand that kids are resilient, that they understand and they don't take a lot of this stuff, you know, personally. So like when you say, hey, 10 o'clock is the curfew, and you mean that 10 o'clock is the curfew, and if you don't make it home by 10 o'clock, then there are consequences as a result of that, it's okay to do. And so a lot of it is that parents don't think that it's okay for them to kind of set these limits and then, you know, kind of follow through with whatever the consequences are. And, you know, giving them the power to be able to say, hey, look, this is it. This is the rule you set. You think this is fair. This kid understood that, that they failed to kind of adhere to that rule, that 10 o'clock curfew, and they made a decision on their own to not follow it. Now there's consequences with that decision. Just as sometimes if we make, you know, a good decision, there are good consequences that come as a result of that. If you make a poor decision, there are, you know, some tough consequences that might come as a result of that. So, you know, maybe that's a loss of privilege. Maybe now this kid can't go out for another, you know, 3 days or a week or whatnot. And, you know, having the family really come up with that stuff, because oftentimes I'll find that parents want me to tell them, you know, what they should do. So what the rules should be for their family. And, you know, I find that kind of unfair because, again, I'm, you know, with them for 1 hour out of a week, you know, discussing this stuff. And you guys are going to have to live with this stuff for the long haul, for the other 6-7 days, all the other hours out of the day and weeks of the year. And so it's something that they've got to come up that's realistic, possible for them to do and for them to keep up. So I always tell parents not to set or come up with a consequence that's too much for them to handle, you know, because, I mean, if you tell them, hey, you can't, you know, watch TV for the next 10 days, and that means for the next 10 days, you got to monitor and make sure that this kid doesn't watch TV. Mm-hmm. And I doubt that you have enough time to really, you know, kind of do that. And
right.
So what happens is that, you know, the second day it's like, oh, screw it. You know, go ahead, watch TV.
Yeah. Yeah. There goes the consequence setting, right? I mean, and then they learn, it's like, okay, well, you can sit there and threaten me with whatever because I know that you're not going to go through it. You'll go through it, right, for a few days and stuff, and then you're going to be like, yeah, whatever. Just, you know, go on and keep on doing. So that does reinforce the bad behavior.
Yep. So it's don't punish yourself along with kind of, you know, consequencing your child as well. So come up with things that are, you know, feasible for you to do and that you're okay with doing, because again, you're going to have to make sure that this stuff happens. So don't come up with something too outlandish that's going to be impossible for you to do.
Make sure that you can do it as a parent.
Yes, absolutely. That is very important. Very important.
You need to set your own rules as a parent.
Yeah.
Like a little reminder. Okay, if Junior doesn't do this, then I need to do that. And you're right. Yeah, I know. Yeah. And don't forget, because they will remember.
Yep. And then again, this kid's banking on the fact that you're going to set up something that you aren't going to be able to adhere to. And then they'll get away, you know, get off early from it. So, you know, it's a delicate balance to kind of create as a parent, to be able to say, well, I want this consequence to be enough to where they understand that they shouldn't have done what they did, but not so much to where that lesson is lost,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so something that's, you know, too severe or too long, again, will, you know, lessen the impact or the desired outcome that you want as a result of the consequence. So, you know, also having that conversation with parents as well.
So what's one of the biggest challenges about being a well-behaved teenager nowadays?
is that I think for parents of kids who aren't, you know, causing problems or anything like that, that they're just okay. And that's not to say that they aren't, but that they don't have any problems. And sometimes they do, and they just got, you know, a better skill set to be able to deal with that stuff. And it's important for parents to kind of still have conversations about it, like, you know, kind of what's going on, check in with them about their day, things like that, and find out how they, you know, navigate the perils and, you know, trials and things that happen throughout the day of being a teen. You know, so when that girl said that you were ugly, you know, how did you deal with that? When, you know, the one kid bumped into you in the hallway and said, you know, these things, like, you know, trying to put you down or wanting to get into a physical altercation, how did you navigate that? You know, because those are important things to understand. And then that sheds light on, you know, kind of what parents did and how this kid is able to cope with, you know, things like that that happen throughout the day. And, you know, the other aspect of that is that, you know, kids who haven't kind of developed these coping skills and strategies, then those are the ones that, you know, end up kind of working with me. So it's important to hear from both sides, kind of, you know, how this kid developed this and what did they do. And maybe that could be kind of, you know, a teaching tool, an opportunity for them to kind of maybe be a peer advisor or something to assist other people. Or, you know, for parents to be able to say, well, you know, I have some friends whose kids are doing X, Y, and Z, and, you know, you were okay with doing it. So maybe they can kind of share that information with their friends.
That's great advice. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that gets out there,
yeah.
You know, because I agree. I think, and you had brought this up in a conversation before about teen lines.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great idea, because sometimes it's just so much easier for teens to hear somebody from their own peer group or their own age group to say, hey, you know what, I've been through what you've been through before, and this is what I did to get out of it or to resolve it, or, you know, this is what I learned from it. I think that should be utilized as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have. There are lots of resources out there for teens to get help with things that they're going through. And, you know, oftentimes we aren't aware of it or they aren't aware of it. And, you know, it doesn't get talked about because it's, well, let's just find a way to fix them. And, you know, they have Teen Line, where this is a hotline that teens can call when they're having issues with, you know, maybe thinking about suicide or, you know, altercations or, you know, anything that may be troubling them, substance abuse, and they can talk to other teens. Other teens will, you know, be a listening ear and then give them advice about, you know, how to kind of deal with that situation. We'll point them in direction of other resources that can help adults to seek out, to get support, things like that. There's also kind of like the suicide teen line, where it's for kids who are really kind of going through a crisis at that moment, they can call to get help from, again, you know, these teen peers, advisors and counselors who are ready to assist. And, you know, like you said, I think it's comforting to know, to get help from someone who's about the same age, who looks like you, going through the same stuff as you. And there's a level of hope that you get out of a teen or someone else who's helping you, who's about your age, when you see that they've made it through and that they've gotten through too. It's important to have that.
Yeah, and it's anonymous, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That, I think that's important too, because I think a lot of teens are very self-conscious and going through self-esteem issues, and that makes it all the more difficult. And of course, the brain's developing and the hormones are firing off, and there's so many things happening developmentally as a teen. I would also like to talk about the bullying issue, because that has been very prominent in the media lately, because there's been so many tragic consequences, especially because of Facebook and social media. Can you talk about that?
Definitely. So the teen years, like I think this is kind of where you were heading, is that they're a transition period. So there's a lot of change, you know, physically that's happening, emotionally. I'm getting to try to figure out who I am as a teen. You know, how do I fit in? If I don't fit in, then, you know, what's wrong with me? And when you start to talk about bullying and how that impacts, whether, you know, it starts earlier on than what we kind of see now with, you know, maybe it's like the high schoolers, the freshmen. Bullying really kind of peaks in that sixth grade. So, you know, this 11, 12-year-olds is kind of where it really hits its peak, and it continues on and it doesn't kind of stop. And when you're talking about cyberbullying with, you know, social media, Facebook, and why that stuff's so tough and kind of, you know, I think catastrophic in terms of the consequences, the outcomes as a result of that, is because there's no escape. So, for example, if I'm getting beat up at school, at some point the bell's going to ring and I get to go home, right? And so maybe, you know, I play sick or feign sick and I don't go back the next day. When it's cyberbullying, there's no real escape. So, I mean, if I open my computer and I log into my email, there's emails telling me how much of a terrible person I am and how much people hate me. Then I go on Facebook and then there, you know, these other things that say, oh, this person's so dumb and stupid and everybody should hate them. Then I go on, you know, Instagram or Twitter, and you never really get an escape from it. And so that's why I think you start to see the suicide come out as a result, because these kids don't get any reprieve. It's constant. It's ongoing. It's daily. And there's no breath or there's no opportunity for escape. And I think that's why bullying or cyberbullying is so tough now. And, you know, kids can be pretty harsh, say the least.
Very blunt, yes.
Yeah, because they, again, it's that developing brain, that thought of that, well, you know, what I'm saying is not going to impact them, or, you know, it's not really my fault. If they choose to do that, then that's on them. And there's, again, that not willing to kind of take responsibility, and also that level of invincibility that, you know, this is not going to be bad outcome for me if they end up doing what I tell them they should do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then there's that sense of power too that's given off by the bully, that you know, they think it's so funny, and you know, everybody's going to think that, you know, they're the greatest for posting those things.
Yep.
But the outcome is just horrendous sometimes. So, what do you recommend to teens who are being bullied like that?
I tell teens all the time that they need to go talk to somebody. So there's this, you know, culture of not really wanting to tell on people, to be a snitch is kind of what they say. But again, you have to get some help, and you have to get some assistance from people who are going to be able to help you. So I work with them to kind of identify an adult that'll be able to kind of deal with this stuff. And then there are, like, you know, techniques that I show them about being assertive and, you know, kind of the difference between being assertive and being aggressive. And assertive is saying, you know, I don't like this. I don't like when you're doing you know, you're posting this stuff on Facebook about me. I really want you to stop. And if you don't stop, then I'm going to have to, you know, tell X, Y, and Z person that, you know, you're doing these things. And I really appreciate it because I don't like it. Aggressive is more kind of, you know, I'm going to go put hands on you or I'm going to make you feel equally as bad. And, you know, so I have conversations like that with teens about how to really stand up to bullying and how to also find someone who can kind of be a support for them through this stuff. Because oftentimes they feel as though they're alone. And it's like what you said, is that the bully gets this sense of popularity, power, you know, and people often don't say things. What you'll find is that the reason, you know, you have a lot of bystanders that people like the peers don't intervene is because they feel that I'll be the next target, right? So if I come to your rescue, then it's going to turn on me. So I don't do anything either. So that's another conversation that I have when I'm also working with teens about that stuff is that it's okay to say something, that, you know, there's strength in numbers. And so if there's a group of you guys who think this is equally wrong, you know, you guys can anonymously go to this person or go to, you know, the principal and leave something here. You know, so I've been working with kind of schools and principals to kind of have like maybe a bullying box or, you know, a way to kind of send these messages that, hey, you know, this kind of stuff is going on and, you know, someone needs to check into it and see what you can do to stop it.
So then the bystanders are somewhat protected too. Maybe it's an anonymous mm-hmm. sort of thing. That's really smart mm-hmm. because I know that's a huge problem too, because I mean, you see so many of these videos like on YouTube,
yep.
bystanders are just almost like numbed out.
Yep.
They're either laughing or they're in shock or they're standing by and they're not doing anything.
Yeah. Well, think about the YouTube videos. I mean, I ask this question usually when I'm doing a workshop you know, how many people see a fight, you know, two hands, a hand will go up and they'll say, oh, it's two people usually fighting. And then how many people are watching that fight? And then you see, oh, about 30 or so. And so there's that disparity and that needs to happen.
I know, that's crazy. Hi, caller.
Hi, I have a question for you all.
Go ahead.
Okay, great. My name is Jennifer, and I was calling to talk about higher education and what may be done in higher education to help with bullying, because we often see that with students as well in graduate and postgraduate programs.
Okay. Yeah, so I think institutions of higher education, they have kind of codes of conduct and things like that they have to follow. But I think the underlying problem were the same. The effects are still the same as when working with teens. So regardless of the age of whether, you know, I'm a senior in college or I'm a, you know, master's student, that the effects of bullying and what that does, you know, makes one person feel less than, beneath, you know, feeling fearful, you know, hurting their feelings, things like that. The effects of that is still the same. So I think that, you know, institutions of higher education have to have that conversation as well, and that they can't shy away and say that, oh, this is the adolescent problem. This is the problem only high schools deal with, that they have to be open to having the conversation. It'll take, you know, people on the campus, maybe one of the student groups to bring that up to maybe the provost or, you know, some of the other, you know, higher up officials, person over student services to be able to discuss that stuff with if it's a real problem. And you can always put together a workshop or bring someone in to kind of talk about that stuff and tailor it to, you know, discuss what it might look like on a college campus, which will be, you know, a little bit different from at an elementary school, middle school, or high school.
Yeah, that's a great point. I know that we see this a lot in higher ed institutions, and we work with the same issues, and many of them feel as though graduate-level students should be sort of in charge of themselves, whereas, you know, youth need somebody to stand up mm-hmm. for them. And so I think we take for granted, or the institutions oftentimes take for granted that this happens, you know, in higher education, and we need to do something about it. So thank you very much for your feedback. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And as we're wrapping up, Steve-On, would you like to give the listeners your contact information?
Yes, they can contact me at my website, www.stevonlewis.com. They can email me at Steve-On Lewis, StevonLewisMFT, Mary Frances Thomas, at gmail.com. Or they can reach me by phone, 310-597-7580.
And thank you so much for being a guest. It was a great topic.
Thank you, Julianne. I really appreciate it.
Very informative. And if you would like to contact me, my email is jgoode8@verizon.net. My business number is 562-234-4650. I do counseling in the Newport Beach, California area. And thank you so much for joining us on Psych One-on-One. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. This is Julianne Good on SkidRowStudios.com.